Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 11th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. This has been a really rough week on Wall Street and for insiders in the City of London. There are pictures in the front pages of newspapers of brokers sitting there pulling their hair out, crying, falling to their knees. After months of promoting the illusion that all is well, that the subprime mortgage blowout will have little effect, that there's no contagion, no systemic crisis. Well, the crisis they said wouldn't happen hit with a vengeance this week, exactly as Lyndon LaRouche had warned in his July 25th webcast. In that webcast, he said that the disintegration of the world monetary system is here now. He said, and I'm quoting Mr. LaRouche from that webcast, and you can get the webcast by going on to LaRouchePack.com and you can get the archive. He said, quote, "What's listed as stock values and market values in the financial markets internationally is bunk. These are purely fictitious beliefs. There's no truth to it. The fakery is enormous. There is no possibility of a non-collapse of the present financial system. None. It is finished now." End of quote. To prevent the complete meltdown of the financial system, the central banks of the world, led by the U.S. Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, pumped more than $323 billion worth of cash into U.S. and European banks in the last 48 hours. You heard me right. They pumped cash into the banks to keep them from blowing up this last couple of days. This was a response to hysterical fears, and we're going to listen to the level of hysteria by picking up from a CNBC Mad Money guru, Jim Cramer, who had what is widely described as a complete meltdown on his show this week. George, do we have the audio?
Who's the pressure?
You're going to have, that's going to cause Armageddon.
No, we have Armageddon. I wouldn't try to cause this. We have Armageddon. In the fixed income markets, we have Armageddon.
No, but that's not what they
say. We have Armageddon.
They say, even when I've talked to a couple banks, they don't say it's Armageddon.
Well, who
they say it's repricing. They're very firm about that.
Oh, great. Okay, well, let them be calm and then have them call me on the way home like they do every night and tell me, Cramer, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to help us? Are you going to help us? Are you going to stand on the sideline like everybody else and say that it's fine? Will somebody come on TV and tell the truth about how bad it is?
But a lot of people say, these same people say, it's not Ben Bernanke and the rate that matters. The bond market
it's
now
no,
is completely
it is the
separate
rate.
From
it's
the rate.
It's entirely
the
rate.
Bond market is trading
no,
separately
it's entirely
from the rate.
Look, we'll spend billions in Iraq to build homes. We are going to have thousands of people. We have thousands of people losing their homes right now. 14 million people took a mortgage in the last 3 years. 7 million of them took teaser rates or took piggyback rates. Mm-hmm. They will lose their homes. This is crazy.
Yes.
I'm sorry to be upset about it, but you have to understand what they're saying to me off the record before I come in here every night and every day, and what I hear from these blowhard managers who act like, call someone for heaven's sake. Go call someone. I worked at fixed income at Goldman Sachs. This is not the time to be complacent.
All right. Now, you got a sense from that of the screaming Jim Cramer, but for once he was telling the truth. But then the same Wall Street hoaxers and speculators who were saying last week that such a meltdown was impossible are now saying that the wall of money which was pumped in as short-term loans demonstrates that the central banks will not allow the situation to worsen. That is, that this is a technical crisis, a monetary credit crunch, a momentary credit crunch that is not systemic. But the financial press is clearly spooked by these developments. The following headlines are representative of the belated recognition by some in the financial world that this is not business as usual. A leading German paper had a headline, "Fear of Worldwide Financial Crash," while the usually restrained Times of London headline today is, "Dead Mortgages Create Global Panic." Joining us today on the LaRouche Show is Helga Zepp LaRouche, who will give her analysis of the nature of this crash, and more important, what measures must be adopted to prevent a deadly global financial economic disintegration. We'll be joined by a panel of members from the LaRouche Youth Movement. I believe we have Vicki Overing from Los Angeles, Maria Channon from Chicago, and hopefully also Matthew Ogden will join us from Leesburg, Virginia. So Helga, welcome to the program.
Hello.
I know you've been studying these developments quite closely. Some of them came out of Germany this week with the IKB Bank, and that you have the benefit of a full global picture. So tell us what happened this week.
Well, actually, I would like to take it back a couple of more weeks, because the change in the public mood among people, not only Jim Cramer, but many, many analysts and so-called economists around the world, has been really remarkable. Because, for example, still in June, the head of the Bank for International Settlement, the Director General Malcolm Knight, said that there would be a golden age for the world economy, and, you know, that prosperity would always go on and it would never, you know, stop. So that was in June. Then, until mid of July, everything seemed to be fine. People were making profit. And then all of a sudden, triggered by essentially two events, one was the beginning collapse of the U.S. subprime mortgage market, and the other thing was the end of the yen carry trade, that you had the most unbelievable reversal of the situation. So on the 25th, Lyndon LaRouche made this webcast you quoted in the beginning, and there he predicted that the system already had collapsed and that, you know, the fallout would simply become apparent for the non-believers in a very short period of time. And it was exactly 3 days later where the collapse of several hedge funds linked to Bear Stearns, Paribas, the French bank, and some other banks in Europe started to really go belly up. And Lyndon LaRouche had also said in this webcast that, you know, the problem was that the physical side of the collapse, namely the collapse of the real economy, the total lack of investment in infrastructure over the last 30 years, meant that, for example, the American transport system was also gone. And again, it took 3 days until the bridge over the Mississippi in Minnesota collapsed, proving once again that Lyndon LaRouche was absolutely right. Now, what has happened is in the last 2 weeks, you had an unbelievable dramatic development. Friday, that is yesterday, 2 weeks ago, the SEC called their counterpart in Germany, the credit authority BaFin, and pointed to the fact that the German middle-level industry EKB Bank was about to go under because of their exposure in the American subprime market. Then, totally unprecedented, the head of BaFin, Sanyo, called 20 leading banks and over the weekend got the agreement of the German government to use the state-owned Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau to bail out this IKB bank with 8.1 billion euro, that's 10 billion dollar. And basically, you know, then the next day the stocks collapsed anyway, and it became very clear that this was just the tip of the iceberg, that in France about 8 hedge funds went under, that you had basically another major bank, Westdeutsche Landesbank, almost going under. Then you had more crisis management meetings of various banks and government agencies. So until mid of this week, which just passed, there was a complete line by Trichet, who is the head of the European Central Bank, saying now is the best time to have the bubble explode, to have a certain adjustment, to get rid of the most wildest of the hedge funds, and that a certain shrinkage and adjustment would be healthy, and that the central banks would absolutely do nothing to intervene.
So this last week, they said,
yeah, until about
the they said, let the crunch happen.
Yes. So that was the line of the Economist. Now is a good time to have an adjustment of the markets. The Financial Times had the same headline endorsing an adjustment of 10, 20 even 25%. And there was a general line that they would do absolutely nothing. But then, obviously, something happened around Wednesday, Thursday this week, and that was obviously that all of a sudden the dimension of this thing became so obvious that there was a complete turnaround, and the European Central Bank, which just had declared they would absolutely do nothing, they intervened within 24 hours, first with 91 billion euro, and then within the same day with another 65 or so billion euro, altogether over 150 billion euro. And then the Federal Reserve did the same thing, and many other central banks in Australia, New Zealand did also interventions of $4 to $6 billion, and many other central banks said they were ready to pump in more liquidity if needed. So what you have in now, you have the very ridiculous situation that a banking system is really in a catch-22, because on the one side they wanted to increase the interest rates because of a very visible inflation, especially in raw materials, in oil, but especially in food. You have a definite visible definitely visible food inflation in China. It was, I think, up to 17%. In Italy, pasta, that is spaghetti, is going up up to 20%. In Germany, bread is making the headlines of going up, which in part is the result of the idiotic biofuel focus, which naturally is leading to an increase of the price for grain production and similar foods. So they wanted to increase the interest rate to curb inflation. But at the same time, you know, Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, who, you know, was basically accused by Jim Cramer of doing nothing, then he had no idea, reminded himself that he has the name Mr. Helicopter Money, referring to a speech he once made a couple of years ago where he said, well, the banking system will always survive, and if there is a real crunch, then we just take helicopters and fly over major cities and pour money down from the helicopters, you know, just bills and bills of dollars and euro and so forth. So he actually did that, and as you said, between Thursday and Friday, between the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve, they poured 323 billion money into the system. And that is not the end of it, because if you think that you have seen the worst of it, this is just the beginning, because now you have a whole bunch of consequences. First of all, the collapse of the American subprime and other mortgage markets is by far not ended, but the so-called adjustable mortgage rates. These were basically mortgage rates where people agreed to have very low mortgage payment for 2 years, but then after 2 years, when these mortgages are sold to other financial institutions, these rates can go up very dramatically. And that is now coming to a full swing, because a lot of this was sold since the spring 2005. So the two-year grace period is coming to an end, and you will see this escalating. This is supposed to peak in October, where mortgages worth 50 billion are supposed to get into higher rates. But that's just the subprime market. Then you have the other phenomena that a lot of the banks financed in the last period the absolute insane mania of mergers and acquisitions, of the takeovers of the so-called locusts. And, you know, basically this was, I think, 470 billion in the first half year of 2007. And now, because of this liquidity crunch, which, you know, was triggered by the ending of the yen carry trade, a lot of these deals cannot be carried through. So the banks are actually sitting now on an enormous amount of deals which they cannot get rid of. For example, the JP Morgan is apparently affected the most. They have the most open contracts of over 52 billion. Bank of America, 41 billion. Citigroup, 33 billion. Deutsche Bank, over 26 billion. And that is just what they admit. But there is a whole area of a gray zone, like the case of Westdeutsche Landesbank, you know, who basically said, oh no, we have no problem, it's all fine. But then it turns out that the entire presidium of Westdeutsche Landesbank knew since half a year how overexposed they were, but they were hiding it from the authorities. They normally should report these, the supervisory board, they normally should report that to. They were hiding it. So now they kicked out the CEO and another member of the board. And the only reason why they kept three other board members who also were guilty of trying to cover up these losses is because if they would be kicked out, then the bank would be completely non-functional. So they keep them in, you know, just to as a damage control, but not because they are not involved in this. So the reality is now the panic has struck, and the greed, which is normally driving these markets, has turned into fear, into angst.
Well, Helga, and it seems that one of the things you're talking about, the ironies, and this is a situation rich with ironies, that they're holding overvalued paper, which no one will buy because they don't think it's worth what it's, the face value is, and no one has the cash to buy it anyway. And then the idea that pumping more money will somehow solve this, that's an irony. But I want to get to the deeper irony that you referenced earlier on this question of the physical economy, because the deeper irony is that the assets are overvalued because we're not producing. The physical economy is what's jammed up. So that brings the question that I'd like you to address, is that the solution that Bernanke seems to have adopted and that the press is praising him for now is the same thing Greenspan did back in 87. When the stock market crashed in October 87, as Lyndon LaRouche had forecast almost to the day, and then again after the tech bubble crashed in March 2000. Why do they think that this wall of money policy can work again when the real economy has shrunken so far beneath it?
Well, I'm not so sure that they really believe it can function, but, you know, these people, they really don't understand the physical economy because they have believed in the profit, money world for so long that I think they just cannot really reverse their thinking. I think this will blow out. I think if they go between, you know, trying to combat inflation by hiking interest rates and at the same time trying to prevent major collapses of hedge funds, private equity funds, banks. The big question here is the banks and how much bad debt do the banks internationally have? It's a fair estimate that all the major investment banks in the G8 countries are bankrupt. So that will become obvious. And if they try to cover that up by pouring more money, then you will end up exactly in the situation like in Germany in 1923, when the hyperinflation, you know, simply destroyed the value of money altogether. The only difference is this time it would not be just in one country, like Germany, where it could be bailed out with the Dawes plan at the time. But this time, it is the entire global world financial system. And, you know, while the globalization supposedly brought so much wonderful profits for the people around the globe, the collapse is also global. And that has just today been pointed out by nobody else than the former super finance and economic minister Tremonti from Italy, who basically, you know, had a conference with Lyndon LaRouche a couple of weeks ago in Italy, and he said, this is it, this is the big question, this is 29, but much worse than even then. So I think we will see this play out, it will get worse and worse for the next weeks, and then will come the question, can the governments of the world get their act together and do the kinds of measures which Lyndon LaRouche has proposed, namely to go in the direction of a new Bretton Woods, to declare the present financial system bankrupt, to basically reorganize the bad debt, write off most of it because it cannot be paid anyway, reorganize some other debt into long-term credits with low interest rates, go for fixed exchange rates and then establish a new financial system in the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the old Bretton Woods. And that is the only chance which exists. Now, Linda LaRouche, my husband, is writing right now a proposal which is the draft platform for the Democratic Party. The reason why he's doing that is because he looked at the different presidential candidates in both parties and said that none of them is presently addressing this crisis in the slightest. I mean, it's almost that the degree of denial of these presidential candidates is really unbelievable and scary, and therefore he is writing right now a proposal how the United States can use the power of the Congress and the power of the Constitution to address this problem, and call the kind of emergency conference with other great powers like Russia, China, India, but then also, you know, countries like Germany, Japan, Brazil, South Africa, and many others to reorganize the system.
Well, Helga, I have that was my next question, but I want to just take a moment here to remind people you're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is Helga Zepp LaRouche, who is our special guest today. We'll be getting to the LIM panel in just a moment. But The LaRouche Show is live every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can get it on the archives. It's on the LaRouchePub.com on the left-hand side where it says LaRouche Show. And you can listen to past shows, and you can go back and see that, in fact, what Helga's saying about the forecasts of LaRouche, that this is what was coming, has been repeated on numerous occasions during the course of this year and the last couple of years. If you have a question for Helga, we can take some email questions today. Send them to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. Helga, you were talking about the conference for a reorganization of the world monetary system, a new Bretton Woods, which has been something that you and your husband have been organizing for years. While the denial is very thick in the United States, and you mentioned in Italy that former Finance Minister Tremonti spoke yesterday of the fact that the system is gone, echoing what Lyndon LaRouche has been saying. You've been involved directly in organizing in Russia, China, and India, the three other nations of the four powers. What is the sense in those countries of the crisis? I mean, clearly, this is a global crisis. What kind of indications are you getting that there's a willingness to go with Mr. LaRouche's proposal?
Well, I think that from my best judgment at this point, each of these countries have, in many high places, the highest respect for Mr. LaRouche. I have been told this personally so many times. In Russia, he is regarded as a legendary figure. In India, he is regarded as the only American they trust. In China, he is highly respected. I think people had illusions up to probably the present moment about the full dimension of the collapse of the system. For example, in Russia, it is very clear that the Russian government and the Russian Academy of Sciences has made many statements and many signals that they would like to put the relationship between the United States and Russia on exactly the platform Mr. LaRouche has been proposing, namely in the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt. That became very evident when he was invited in April of this year to address, as one of the major speakers, a conference on the building of the Bering Strait as you know, the link between Siberia and Alaska, which the government and the organizers of this conference very clearly presented as a war avoidance policy in stark contrast to the danger of a new Cold War erupting out of the idea the United States has by putting anti-ballistic missile and systems and radar stations in Poland and Czechia. And it was said very clearly at that conference, you know, that the La Rouge policy of war avoidance through great projects is what the Russian government really wants. So there has been many other important signals, which I cannot go in through here for time reasons. But I think that there has been a responsiveness by Putin, by President Putin, by other Russian officials to go in the direction of Franklin D. Roosevelt, because when the 125th birthday of Roosevelt took place at the beginning of the year, you had huge celebrations, not in the United States, but in Russia. And many speakers called Franklin D. Roosevelt the greatest of all great Americans, and that Putin himself said that Russia needs a new deal and that the whole world needs a new deal. So I think that there is a big, big openness. And I think the same is true for China in a different way. For example, there was a big fluff this week about supposedly, you know, China using its dollar reserves to bring down the dollar, which was then denied by the Chinese government. And, you know, the story behind that was that when the American Congress, I'm not sure if it was the Congress or the Senate, they voted this anti-Chinese bill before they left for the summer recess.
To raise tariffs against China.
Yes, exactly. So that was regarded very bitter by China. And they told to my husband directly and personally that they would make clear that they do not take these things without answers. So, you know, while the story as such was not, you know, it was not really true that they had threatened to bring down the dollar by dumping their huge dollar reserves, but they also made very clear that there is a limit to their patience. And they have also made very clear that they are not going to submit under the idea of a world empire, which Condoleezza Rice has declared many times by stating that the United States would never allow that one country or a group of countries would reach the power of the United States economically or militarily. And the Chinese have also made very clearly that they do not believe that that is the place China is willing to take. They have been very open for the ideas of the Eurasian land bridge instead. And you can see that, you know, while the idea of going to a new Bretton Woods system and to have the Eurasian land bridge as the cornerstone of a reconstruction program for the world, met for a long, long period of time, people said, oh, that's just the idea of La Rouge and his movement, but it will never come true. But you can see right now that that's what we have been campaigning for, namely that the Eurasian land bridge is coming into being. Not only is the Bering Strait, which is a gigantic project, I mean, it involves 6,000 kilometers of railway connecting the Trans-Siberian Railroad through the 100-kilometer tunnel under the ocean, through the Bering Strait, then all the way from Alaska, Canada, to the United States. And the people who are pushing this project, they really want to go it all the way down to Chile. And at this Bering Strait conference, people were totally excited. They said, well, look, if we build this strait, if we develop the Siberian raw materials, which is a tremendous technological challenge because you have to develop these raw materials under permafrost conditions. But, you know, these are the richest raw material reserves in the world. But then, you know, you can build the maglev and then you can travel, let's say, from Acapulco via the Bering Strait all the way to Mumbai in India more quickly than you can go by ship over the oceans now.
Well, so Los Angeles, in Los Angeles, we're looking forward to a Los Angeles to Moscow trip. Helga, you're having a conference in Berlin coming up to take this further, the organizing process. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's basically the idea that, you know, given the fact that we have been listening for quite some time to the wise words of Mr. La Rouge, I assumed that the financial turmoils would be, you know, really sharpening tremendously by the period of the September, months of September. And at the other side, you have all these exciting elements of the Eurasian land bridge coming into being. I just was about telling you a couple of them. I could tell you many more aspects. For example, the Indian government is building a 1,400-kilometer corridor from Delhi to Mumbai, which will affect the economic life of 180 million people. And there are many, many other projects which were in our initial land bridge report from 1996. So my idea was to say, okay, you have on the one side the financial system coming down, and on the other side you have an emerging alternative, namely that the Eurasian land bridge is being built. Many, many elements of it are being built. And so therefore I said, well, why don't we bring this optimism, which is going on in many parts of the world. For example, China is planning to build more than 30 high-temperature reactors. Now, that is an inherently safe form of nuclear energy. It was developed in Germany by Professor Schulten from the Jülich Research Center, and it was given at the time practically totally ready to the Chinese because of the crazy environmentalist movement in Germany. Professor Schulten thought that it was politically not realizable in Germany, but that this was too important a technology to be wasted, you know, and be somewhere in the closet. So the Chinese built a test reactor, which is now functioning already since a couple of years, and now they're building large numbers of high-temperature reactor, not only for China, but also for export. So does South Africa. South Africa has presently the most advanced modular pebble bed high-temperature reactor of the same type as the one the Chinese are building, but it's just the most advanced version of it. And they are planning to build it for export for all of Africa and beyond. Then you have India planning to build a nuclear cycle based on thorium, which is also very good because it cannot be used for military purposes. So then you have many, many countries discussing that they want to have maglev trains. In Denmark, the Schiller Institute managed to get a whole national debate about infrastructure, about building bridges, several large bridges of 40, 50 kilometers, building maglev, connecting the major cities in Denmark in the hope that eventually they would connect to Hamburg, Berlin, Moscow, Beijing. Finland is building new nuclear reactors. Sweden, of all places, wants to have nuclear reactors now. All the Maghreb countries, that is the northern African countries, want to have nuclear energy. All the Gulf states want to have an 11,000-kilometer long maglev line. So the idea of the conference was basically to say, okay, on the one side, the system is coming down, but you have all these very, very positive initiatives in terms of reconstruction of the world economy around great projects, around advanced technology. So why don't we have a conference to bring all of these ideas together to really demonstrate to all the participants and German government and German institutions and European institutions that an alternative is very, very close. So the timing of this conference could not have been better.
This is how optimism can overcome hysteria. Let me bring in the LaRouche Youth Movement panel now, but before I do, I want to encourage people, because of the limited time we have, there's much, much more breaking by the hour on the financial crisis. Also, many, many more of these projects that Helga has just referenced, the reports on them are being posted regularly on the LaRouchePact.com website, which I was told yesterday had a huge spike in numbers of people logging onto it, because obviously people want to know, what is Lyndon LaRouche saying about this financial crisis? So get ahead of the curve. Get on the LaRouchePact.com website right now, and you can get the updated picture, not just financially and not just why these guys are hysterical, but what to do about it. Do we have Matthew Ogden on? Matthew, are you there? Are you there? Okay, I guess Matthew was detained in the war room today, but we do have Maria from Chicago. Maria, are you on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, what are you thinking about from listening to this picture that Helga just described?
Well, hi, Helga. I guess I still have the wrong perception of what a crash is, because I don't quite understand why the crash has already happened. So if you could go through that more.
Well, I mean, essentially what we are seeing right now is not some cyclical crisis where you have a little, you know, recession and then basically things go back. The problem is that what people don't understand is that a paradigm shift of the last almost 40 years of replacing a productive society based on science and technology and progress and physical production with the utopia of a post-industrial society, a service sector, you know, basically the whole totally crazy a system of, you know, money makes money, of just-in-time production, of outsourcing of expensive jobs to cheap labor markets, to, you know, this whole package of wrong economic thinking, which was geared entirely only to get the shareholder value satisfied and to have the greed of the population or that part of the population which speculates satisfied at the expense of real production. So what you have right now is not only like 29 and a depression like the 30s, but, you know, in a certain sense, the situation in the 30s was much, much better than now, because when Roosevelt did the New Deal, he could just give credit to anybody who would produce, and then people would start to produce because the industrial and agricultural capacities still existed. Now, if you look in the United States, you have essentially three large areas where you still have machine tool capacities. That's on the one side naturally the military complex, then you have a certain amount of aerospace, and you have the car industry. But you do not have middle-level industry. I mean, you do not find the typical structure of the economy of Germany, Switzerland, Northern Italy, or certain parts of France, where, for example, in Germany, 85% of all production is in the realm of middle-level industries. These are highly productive firms where most of the patents are developed, which are later used by the large corporations and bought up. But the ingenuity and the creativity of the German economy is located in this Mittelstand. So the United States has totally destroyed that by outsourcing, by, you know, just, you know, yeah, outsourcing to cheap labor areas. So therefore, now with the auto sector collapse, which really, you know, was warned against by Lynn, by my husband, but since the Congress didn't act on it, well, you have now certain, you know, financial corporations sucking the blood of whatever is left. But a whole bunch of industry and machine tool has been wiped out. So what you have right now is a gigantic financial superstructure, a balloon, the so-called derivative credits and other creative financial instruments which Greenspan invented, and you have basically outstanding contracts and payments to make for which you have no money. So when you had this liquidity pumping, which was essentially one of the major channels was the yen carry trade, where speculators could go to Japan, take loans for zero interest, and then go to higher yield markets in other currency zones, speculate in bubbles, and, you know, then basically make gigantic profits. Since this pyramid had created a situation where, for example, people would lend money from banks, then turn around and lend that money to somebody else, so becoming, you know, the lender to a new borrower who would do exactly the same thing, take money and then lend it out again. And that way you have a gigantic chain which, you know, is totally irrational, and it only functions as long as the asset prices increase in value. And the hedge funds and private equity funds are structured in such a way that they have to make a lot of profit because they have to, you know, service all of these contracts, and therefore they are dependent on making profits of up to 20% or more. And as long as this balloon is increasing, everything is fine. And then you have such people like the head of the BIS saying, oh, a golden age has started. But if this comes to a reversed leverage, then it turns out this is all fictitious. This money does not even exist. It's not. It's worse than Germany 1923, because in 1923, the Reichsbank would print physical money. They would print notes of Reichsmark, first, you know, 100 Reichsmark for a bread, a pound of bread, then 1,000, then 1,000,000, then 1,000,000,000, and then in the end 1,000,000,000,000, and then the whole thing came to a screeching halt because it became ridiculous. But the Reichsbank did at least print real money. Now, as Bernanke said himself in a famous speech, there are so many wonderful ways of creating electronic money. You have like 100 ways of creating electronic money, and this money is simply existing in computers. So if you have a reverse leverage, then, you know, you can as well push the delete button in your computer and it all goes. And then you see what remains, namely you have no physical economy, and therefore the rebuilding job which needs to be done now is much more severe and much more challenging than even what Franklin D. Roosevelt had to do, because the industry has to be rebuilt and the labor force has to be trained, and the rebuilding therefore will be much, much harder.
Helga, one of the ways we see that is with the infrastructure, where every year there are billions of dollars that should be allocated for repairing levees, for example, in New Orleans, or this bridge in Minneapolis, or one quarter of the bridges in the United States. And by not spending that money for that, it appears as though there's money for other things, like a war, the Cheney's war. We do have a question from James in California, an email. He asked, well, how about rebuilding and repairing the present U.S. infrastructure? Clearly, this is something that Lynn has been talking about for years. This would require this kind of banking reorganization that you're talking about.
Yes, I mean, it's very clear that you could not finance that from a present ongoing household, from an ongoing budget. This is why Lynn has recently revived two initiatives which he had formulated much earlier. One is the Economic Recovery Act of 2006, which was essentially this proposal to retool the auto industry, and there in particular the machine tool sector and machine tool design sector, to basically, you know, really now take whatever is left of this capacity and really build infrastructure. For example, you could take some of the same machine tool capabilities to build sluices for water systems. You could build railway, maglev trains. You can build other parts of infrastructure, nuclear reactors, inherently safe HTR reactors, because also in the energy field, you have a gigantic underinvestment. You needed to invest more in energy than the present energy capacities are worse, if you want to prevent a total blackout of the U.S. economy in the very near future. So, you know, that is what needs to be done, and the financing of it has to occur through a special national infrastructure bank, because this is a gigantic job, and it should not be part of the general budget, but it should be geared for long-term investment of 20, 25, 30, 50 years, because infrastructure has an average lifespan of about 30, 35 years, and it's completely insane to take a financing approach which is basically less than that age. So that will be on the table when the Congress comes back. I mean, it could be that they have to come back much earlier. If this thing continues to tumble, and, you know, I think it will, maybe the Congress does not enjoy their vacation so much, and they will have to come back much earlier. But if they don't come back earlier, there are already scheduled hearings on the infrastructure situation in the United States for September 5th. Whenever it will be. They have to deal with that, and they have to really take responsibility, because one problem is that the population is obviously very, very angry. The fact that the popularity of the Congress is at this point 3%, that is even less than Cheney, you know, really tells you something. If these people want to be re-elected, they better remember that they are responsible for the common good.
Well, there's an angry mood in the population. I mean, one minute a bridge is there, the next minute it's not. One minute your pension fund is there, and the next minute it's gone in a puff of smoke. And so I would encourage everyone listening to the program today to find out if your congressman is having a town meeting, if he or she is going to be in town. Go there and bring up this question. Will you support a new Bretton Woods, or are you going to bail out the predators? Now, we do have, I believe, Vicki is on from Los Angeles. Vicki, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, you have a question for Helga or a comment?
Yeah. Helga, your article, Green Turns to Angst, The House of Cards is Collapsing, and you mentioned this today in the call about this, the IKB being the tip of the iceberg, only the tip of the iceberg. And I just like the analogy that you used of the Titanic, because it could describe the financial system, like the iceberg being the financial system hitting the population, but it could also be like the mentality, like how people are reacting to it. Because I've noticed in organizing out on the street that there's different reactions. Like there could be some reaction with the financial people, where they're freaking out, but then other areas like California, a lot of people just don't even know what's going on. Where they're still sipping their latte, they're trying to get the next deck chair on the Titanic, you know, in the highest level or whatever. And so I just wanted to ask you about, like, how do you address that? Because you know, a lot of the axiom is about money, you know, and stuff like that, but I haven't been able to figure out a way to overcome that axiom, or how to communicate this financial crash with people.
Well, I think the problem you are describing is that part of the reasons for this crisis is the change of values in the population. I mean, Lynn has basically talked and written about that many, many times, that basically people have really been, well, I think they have been driven away from the axioms which made Franklin D. Roosevelt possible by many, many waves of social engineering, which has left most of the population in Europe, Japan, and the United States in a form of denial which can only be described as clinically insane. That is my firmest belief, because if people have such a very well developed form of denial, well, then they are not focused on reality, and if somebody cannot perceive reality, well, then they're clinically insane. That is not an insight, that is just a clinical medical description. Now, the way this functions is that you have practically different groupings in society who have their own belief structure as a grouping. And the internal repetition and confirming of that belief structure serves as a cushion against reality. And, you know, this belief structure is basically reinforced by certain dogmas, by certain, you know, holy cows, by certain, you know, things which are absolutely untouchable. Now, one of these dogmas, for example, is that the central bankers will always have means to fix it, that they have a limitless variety of instruments which they can manipulate the markets, and therefore they will always control it. Now, that mythology is just being smashed, and you will see that it is going to be smashed much more. So, you know, the way I see this right now, I don't know if you ever saw when a big house is detonated with these large Harley, you should help me to find this word.
Yeah, so the way they do the explosions of old buildings to bring them down.
No, I don't mean explosions. It's like big, like iron or steel balls, and they bang them against it. How are they called?
Not
I know
sure.
The German word.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, maybe you have seen it. They swing it, you know, like on a pendulum.
Ah.
And when this ball hits, then the whole structure falls in itself together. Now, that is what's happening with this mechanism of denial right now. I mean, you should be prepared that the same people who tell you today, oh, there is no problem, tomorrow will freak out and totally scream at the top of their lungs, like this Jim Cramer, where, funnily enough, when I heard that the first time, I actually thought it was like Stephen Colbert satire. I didn't see, because he said, he has no idea, Bernanke has no idea. And I said, I thought it was a joke. But then people told me, no, he really means it.
Yeah.
And that you will see happening a lot. So all these denials will address, and you should just be very, very calm and tell people, you know, like, for example, we had the same phenomena in Germany with the hits on our website, which was a record yesterday, simply because, you know, the headlines of all the newspapers were full, the crash is on, the EZB intervention. So people naturally go to our webpage to find out what is the solution. So you should prepare yourself, you know, to really intervene in the coming period, because this denial cannot hold.
I think the one thing that happens sometimes when the denial disappears is you get a certain amount of depression. And that's, of course, why it's essential that the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing what it's doing by going out and showing that there are solutions to this problem, that Lyndon LaRouche has been addressing this. He is competent. There is a precedent with Franklin Roosevelt. And Maria, I wonder, I know you're in Chicago right now. What kind of response are you getting from the population there to the financial blowout?
Well, we had a lot of fun yesterday. We had the intention of going down to the financial district, so we made a banner, which on the top it says, "You don't have to jump." And in the middle of the banner, it's a picture of a dead bull on top of a dead bear with blood coming out. And on the bottom it says, "LaRouche has the plan." So we went to the financial district and we sang, and we got some pretty interesting responses. You know, a lot of people were looking at the banner, some people just standing around observing the organizing, and a couple people, total freakouts, like taking the pamphlet and then throwing it on the ground, a couple of men in suits doing that. And then in our conversations, there was at least one broker who admitted that, yeah, you can't continue this process of the hedge funds forever. And wanted to know, a lot of people just wanted to know what LaRouche's plan was. And another young finance major also just had a, you know, very interesting response. He understood the banner right away. He understood what that meant with the dead bull and the dead bear. And just a lot of people interested in knowing what the solution is. And people generally understanding that free trade and globalization isn't working. What we're doing right now isn't working, so what's the alternative?
Okay,
pretty fun.
Again, I just emphasize people should organize your friends and relatives and coworkers to get on the LaRouche PAC website to follow this and to become active. And if you want to get some literature, you want to get involved, you can give us a call. It's a toll-free number, 888-347-3258. Now, we have a little less than 7 minutes to go, Helga, and I think it's important that we not lose sight of the fact that Dick Cheney is down in a bunker somewhere looking for an excuse to launch an attack against Iran, possibly blow up Pakistan and Afghanistan. What's the latest we're getting from the crisis spots and the danger of an expanded war?
Well, the problem right now is that you have, first of all, the situation in Iraq totally out of control. I mean, much, much worse than the media are reporting. I mean, you have a situation which is really, you know, at the edge, because a lot of the rebellion of the Sunnis inside Iraq is really financed by certain Saudi channels, which makes all the more absurd that the U.S. government wants to sell this gigantic armament deal to Saudi Arabia. And they blame Iran for being behind the rebellion in Iraq, while in reality it is really mainly certain Saudi channels which, you know, blows up the situation completely.
Yeah, Chinese so allies.
What?
Chinese allies, the Saudis.
Exactly. So what basically many military and other sources we are talking with are very concerned about is that you have right now four aircraft carriers in the Gulf, and they will be there in the region throughout the month of September, having maneuvers in the Bay of Bengal and many other warships with them. And as one retired top general told us, is you do not put so much military equipment in such a small area if you don't want to use it. So the slightest incident as a pretext, either a terrorist attack somewhere, you know, in the United States or in Europe, or another Gulf of Tonkin event, and that would be then the pretext to launch a military attack against Iran. And that would then throw the world immediately into a global asymmetric warfare. Now, the danger is that, you know, basically people who are observing President Bush from a psychological standpoint are very concerned that, you know, they say that if Bush feels cornered, he tends to lash out. That is his profile. Now, what people should be very wary about is that if the financial markets continue to go in these kinds of turbulences, and, you know, the anger of the population at Bush is also tremendously, because as some headlines were writing, Katrina moved to Minnesota, meaning that, you know, the outrage of the population in Louisiana and in other places that the government did not solve the aftermath problems of the Katrina catastrophe, and many, many thousands of people are still homeless, are still sitting in desperate places, not only in New Orleans, but in wider areas. But the same negligence was demonstrated in the case of the Minnesota bridge, where Bush basically said, no, there is no money, the Congress is making wrong priorities, and there's nothing we can do. But that basically, when Bush will be confronted with the coming turbulences, and with Cheney still being in the place where he is, that the danger that an incident can be created, which then is the pretext for a diversion, and that Bush then being cornered will simply lash out and says, okay, let's do it. I mean, this Damocles sword is hanging over the world, and people should not be complacent. We are in a very dangerous moment of history. It can be solved, but the large part of the solution has to come from the United States. That means we have to get the Democratic Party in a different mental attitude. They have to be, you know, not financed by the hedge funds, but they have to address the concerns of the 80% of the forgotten people, forgotten men and women. And we have to get the moderate Republicans to understand that they have a gigantic responsibility, and they cannot allow that this present administration is, you know, going to really lead the world into a disaster and Armageddon by launching a new war against Iran. But that really requires that people remember, you know, I was driving through some places here a couple of days ago, and I was reflecting, you know, about the United States, which is such a beautiful country and a country of such contradictions. On the one side, you know, the country right now is hated in the world. I think most Americans have not an inkling, not only by the Arabs and the Muslims, forget that, by everybody, by people in India, in Russia, in China, in Europe. The image of the United States has never been so bad, and the reputation never been so so really down. But it would be so easy if the United States would now take the initiative and say, okay, we will address the fact that this global system is really not working, and we are pulling together a new Bretton Woods together with other great countries of the world. The friendship and the love of the people of the world could be regained if there would come bold leadership from the United States right now. Now, the only way that will happen is that people in the United States have to do now what Lopez Portillo told me in 98 when I visited him in Mexico for the occasion of a conference around the issue of Alexander von Humboldt. He said, the world now has to listen to the wise words of Lyndon LaRouche. And I think that that is what has to occur now, and it has to occur in the United States.
Well, that was good advice then. It's even better advice now. Helga, thank you so much for joining us today. I would encourage people to get on the website, LaRouche Pack and LaRouche Pub. Helga's article will be in the next EIR that will be posted, I believe, in the next day or so on the strategic crisis. Vicky and Maria, thank you for joining us. This has been the LaRouche Show. Join us next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and hopefully we'll have more reports by then of motion toward both a new Bretton Woods and the early retirement of Vice President Cheney. Thank you, Helga.
Okay, till soon.
Okay.